Twilight Connection.
In our podcast series so far, Stephen, we've talked a lot about the environment more generally and on a wider scale. I wondered if you could share some of your ideas and your thoughts on the classroom environment and why that's so important for learning in general, but also how it can specifically help language learning in particular.
I think a lot of folk know me. I've been a professor for over 30 years, you know, officially old. And you know, in the early days, of course, we were looking at the impact of technology on learning. Huge. Back in those days, you know, we had to, it was all a bit DIY, you know. When we first had the internet, we had to write our own browser to be able to look at it, you know. But then later on, you know, we found ourselves, you know, with the Internet of Things, with big data, with cloud-based information, and we started looking seriously at the actual learning space itself. We thought we'd be clever and build some little boxes that captured as much information as we could find, because I think every teacher listening to this, every student for sure, will tell you that, you know, the classroom's a bit hot, it's soporific, you know, and if it's, you know, the CO2 levels are a bit over the top, or, you know, they'd probably say it feels a bit muggy, you know, they find it really hard to concentrate. So we started with a really big literature survey of what do we know about the brain anyway, and it dawned on us that the parallel really was with English sport. Where, you know, I think at the Atlanta Olympic Games, we won one gold medal. Vincent de Redgrave. Back in those days, we were a top nation at sitting down sports, you know, any sport. You know, so cycling, rowing, sailing, horse riding, and Formula One. We were a top nation, but as soon as we stood up, we were rubbish. So, well, one of the things we realized, I think, back in the 90s was that doing a better version of what you used to do wasn't enough. What you needed to do was look at every detail. And that whole aggregation of marginal gains that propelled the cyclists. I think in Rio, every single cyclist that went to Rio came home with a medal.
Doing 100 things 1% better, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit simplistic to say if you do 20 things 1% better, you'll be 20% better, but you sure as hell will be better. And we'll come to numbers in a bit because the numbers are quite scary. So to our surprise, really, nobody had really done this work. The research data was everywhere. You know, the data on noise was very good, and a lot of it came out of car design because they were worried about the impact of car tire noise and stereo systems. You know, at what point is it so loud you can't concentrate? It turned out to be not very loud. So we collected all that and thought, okay, let's look at classrooms. Let's start measuring the learning space. And it was a bit of a OMG moment because, first of all, I think we went into, I think it was 83 or 86 examination rooms. And we didn't find one that wasn't damaging the children's prospects very often profoundly. But worse still, we found incredible unfairnesses because, you know, kids in the dark corner, badly ventilated, were always going to do 3.5% worse than the kids in the well-ventilated light corner. So we thought, Lord have mercy, you know, this is bad. And then the more we started looking at the data, the worse it got. So we started off looking at CO2, and we thought then, back in those days, you know, we thought 2,200 ppm parts per million was like a lot of CO2. Nowadays, we know that 1,000 is a lot. So the point at which damage occurs turns out to be much sooner than we thought. And, you know, I'm sitting here on the East Coast. There's a snowdrift outside the door. The chickens are looking less than impressed, you know. The temperature in my little room here is 16 degrees, and we know that 18 to 21 is pretty optimal for learning, so I'm not far off. So then we started looking at the things nobody had really thought about. Humidity, noise rhythms, TVOCs, those nasty smells you get when you glue something or fresh paint or whatever, you know. And we started to see some astonishing things. We're sitting on about 5.5 million hours of data now, you know, and we saw some flipping amazing stuff. For example, just within this last year, TVOCs, those volatile organic compounds, have gone through the roof. And of course, it's because of COVID, because people are deep cleaning the classroom. So they got the cleanest desks you've ever seen. But unfortunately, in doing so, they brainwashed the kids, you know. So you've got kids who are never going to be ill, but it really doesn't matter because they're walking around like zombies, you know. And one thing, I mean, people will be amused to hear, particularly girls listening, I think. We found in some mixed secondary schools, the TVOC count went really high. just before lunch, and we were trying to work out what it was, but it was boys spraying themselves with the Lynx, you know, before going out to, you know, to hopefully a romantic assignation, you know. But the girls, on the other hand, had opted for washing, which I think was probably a better route, you know.
So old-fashioned.
Yes, yeah, so, that's so last century. Yeah. So yeah, the whole thing was full of surprises, and then, of course, it's no good rushing around shouting out, oh, you know, help, help, the sky's falling, you know, what can we do about it? Turns out to be really, really easy. So, for example, we ran a project called BYOP, Bring Your Own Plant, and we had every kid with their own plant. We knew what the best plants were because, luckily, I'm doing some work with NASA, which is like everybody would want to do work with NASA, you know. I'd always wanted to go to Mars, you know. But it turns out when you go to Mars, you need to take plants with you because they'll convert the CO2 back into oxygen and help things along. And NASA thought, oh, I wonder what the best plants are, so we know what the best plants are. When we started putting them into classrooms, unbelievable results. You know, Chris, we were getting, you know, ADHD cut by 3/4. You know, kids who'd been on Ritalin. And turns out what was wrong with the kid wasn't the kid that had the attention deficit. It was the environment was depositing their attention, you know. And when we started graphing the difference between not opening your windows in the classroom, opening your windows or opening the door, we found that, of course, if you don't open the windows, you know, on a typical day, 27 kids in a classroom, the CO2 will be beyond the point when it distracts them from their learning about half an hour into the day. So teachers will think, I wonder why the classes are always so sharp-eyed at registration, you know, because that's a lot, really, after that. Oh, God, you know. You know, and we walked in with, obviously we're doing projects all over the place of transforming classrooms. I remember we were doing one near here, Little Fingering Hoe Primary School, went in with the kids, and, you know, it's a one-form entry coastal school, you know, in a kind of interesting area. And, you know, I said to the kids, this was in sort of May, I think the year before, coming up to lunchtime, who are the kids who are a bit naughty and they're kind of, you know, just not really on the money and they're kind of looking around and falling off their chair. And they all pointed to these boys in the corner who looked a bit, yeah, it's us, it's true, you know. And I said, well, so who are the ones who are kind of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed coming up to the end of the day when the mums are waiting outside? Hang on, I'm just going to finish my buffalo, you know. And they all pointed to a mixed group over by, of course, when we looked at the mixed group who were sharp as, you know, luckily the glass was broken in the window, it was nicely ventilated, a great natural light, there was a LED light above their heads, ventilation, light, temperature was all right, the boys in the bad boy corner, you know? So we swapped them over, you know. Remember one of the girls saying, I've only been here an hour, I feel myself going over to the dark side.
But isn't that amazing, because that impact that can have on a child's school career from the beginning can be enormous. If they get identified as a difficult child or a troubled child, and it could just be the environmental aspect of it, which is the issue.
It absolutely is, you know, because people are doping them down with drugs. I mean, obviously ADHD is real. You know, kids are sort of all sorts of, you know, alcohol-induced syndromes and all sorts of things, you know, but it's a long, long way from all of them. And also, you know, I've stood so many times now in a class with a teacher, drawn a little map on a bit of paper and said, I'll tell you about this later, turned it over, and the class starts, and, you know, we're a little way, and somebody yawns, and I just say to the teacher, didn't notice someone yawning, you know, and then a couple of others start fidgeting and doing something inappropriate. I turn a bit of paper over and it says, the first kid to yawn is going to be sat there. The first kids to fidget are going to be in that part of it. I mean, it's starkly obvious. And just like with the Olympic stuff, once you realise that there's more to it than doing what you've always done, you know, wow, the eyes open and it goes off. And of course, Chris, I mean, a big part of this is agency, you know, the kids are fascinated by all this. Well, it wasn't me, it was the room, you know.
And just the idea of something as simple as bringing their own plant in, they identify, I can make a difference to my learning. And it's that individual responsibility, but also to the group as well.
No, absolutely spot on. And we've taken that further because we've plant-based thing, and we make them put the plants in a white pot because we know how important light is. I'll come to light in a minute, but, you know, the plants are absorbing light for photosynthesis, so if it's a white pot, they're reflecting light back into the room. But we make each child name their plant. And there's something about it's your plant, you know. They get really excited when their spider plants having babies, you know, and they're getting quite, you know, oh, you know, they're getting all sort of flustered about it all. But they've got skin in the game. And we've had kids who've been poor attenders who, once they've got their own plant, you know, find themselves coming in because they've got family in the room, you know. It's and of course the STEM kids make little Arduino self-watering kits to hang on the flower pot for 20 quid worth of sensors, and you know, some of the more turbulent kids try different fluids on the plant. I'm going to weed on mine, I'll see what happens, you know. You know, the kind of thing, you know. I've tried mine on Coca-Cola. Yeah. It's not very well, you know.
But they're experimenting, they're critically thinking, they're reflecting on their environment and their place within it.
Oh, absolutely. It's metacognition, you know, they wrote large and in capital letters, and it is that reflective practice. But it's also the sense that nothing is inevitable and you can impact on all of it. And probably that was the point with the, you know, going back to those Olympic teams in the 90s, you know, you had a coach who'd probably come out of the armed forces, and if you did it wrong, you'd have to do 20 press-ups and say, sorry, sir. As always, sir, you know. Now, if I look at the coaches that I work with, and I work with still the Olympic team, the rugby folk, all sorts, you know, if I look at them, you know, I can barely differentiate between the, you know, the coaches, the data analysts, you know, Liverpool Football Club doing pretty well at the moment. Over the last few years, they've got, you know, their head of data has a theoretical physics PhD. And he has 11 full-time data analysts working under him. And I walk into a classroom and people can't even tell me, well, what's the average arrival time? Who's always... I mean, this is kind of common sense with data, really, Chris. You know, it's if you arrange a room in a variety of zones, and the zones support a sort of carousel of pedagogy, and I'm going to be conversation with just two of the city over there, we're just trying out our conversation skills. I've got little sort of cafe desks over here. I'm getting ready to do a presentation, and here I've got my head down. I'm doing quiet reading and work, and as I move from one area to another, it all kind of improves. And we absolutely know that lots of things happen with that, and we know that the flow of blood to their brains, because we can map it these days with functional MRI scanners, their brains are more active if they move within the lesson. I mean, you can see it. One brain's lit up like a Christmas tree, the others, many of us, I think, have said to children before a test, take your time, calm down, collect your thoughts. We now know, you know, they'd be better off doing somersaults, you know, it's like musical chairs. Yeah. Keep moving around the room. When the test starts, sit down and write, but, you know, not until. However, you know, that variety of seating has a huge impact on punctuality. The kids all arrive really early. They hurry to class because you got more choices. And, you know, if you turn up and the seats are the same and the desks are the same and you're sitting in a, you know, you've got a seating plan. So I'm sitting next to Chris and, oh, dear God, he's walking.
No one wants to do that, no.
Nobody wants to do that. And he's had that cardigan on for the last two terms. You know, it's nothing much to say there, you know. And
for the purposes of the tape, we are destined, you know, I don't know how Stephen can know that, but it is true, even though we are doing this on Zoom.
Yeah, no, he's looking elegantly, bashfully elegant, I might say. Yeah, but what we've learned from all this is the complexity of that, and you know, kids bite onto it and then expect, you know, and you know, as you say, nobody wants to just sit in the same seat with the same person. So they arrive late because there's no joy in that. And it's kind of interesting just putting a COVID spin on this for a moment, because there's been a lot of complete tosh talked in the media about COVID kids needing to catch up and, oh, you know, heavens to Murgatroyd, they need to be back in school, you know. But we know that the very opposite's true. The kids out there, almost all of them and not all, so there's an equity issue, but most of them have been pursuing lots of things in depth. They've been, you know, looking at rocketry, they're doing baking, they're doing living history, talking to their grandparents more than they've done for a long time. They're, you know, they've really thrown themselves into their learning. And what they've developed are really key for the millennium skills of you know, agility, of innovation.
Resilience.
Resilience. I mean, think about all the things computers can do. Computers never tire. Computers do batch processing. Computers do what they're told. Computers do repetition. Computers do memory. So the last thing we need is a generation of kids who can only do those things. We need a generation of kids who are ingenious and curious and can, exactly as you say, be resilient. And, you know, if I look back, when was the last time we had the generation like that? It was Second World War, when all those kids were evacuated for 3 years and the people bombed them, and heaven only knows what they went through. And hiding in the bomber shelters every night in the garden or going down the underground, you know. And yet that lot, that generation gave us Vivian Westwood and Paul McCartney and Colin Chapman and, you know, the geniuses, the engineering, science, music, art, design geniuses that we rebuilt Europe on for 20 years after the war. Well, this generation of kids, with all the things they've learned out of school, are a golden generation. They're our most precious generation, and they won't be. And the sad thing is that we've got, you know, it's not the politicians' fault that they can't see that, because they're a generation who've only ever seen the same thing. They've sat in the seating plan. They've done the daily timetable. They've only ever faced certainty. So when they're faced with uncertainty, they say, oh, let's get back to where we get them back in school, get them sat down. In fact, get all facing the same way. I'm sure COVID needs that. You know, they've kind of locked onto, that's not their fault, but they are stupid. You know, that's the truth of it. You know.
Do you see, when you've made many of these changes in classrooms, these environmental changes, has that affected the pedagogy that's used in the classroom by the teacher? Has it had that crossover benefit?
Yeah, I mean, hugely so. And sometimes people are reluctant to see that. I remember we did I'm a professor in Spain these days, as you know, UCJC in Madrid, and we did a project there. We had a wonderful teacher, Michael, who, you know, for 3 years, when we got the kids to make over their classroom, was a comparison thing. We got one to make it over with no money and one where we funded the makeover. And I'll tell you about what happened in a minute. But he spent most of the first year, you know, tell me what you want to do. And he became, you know, a kind of moderation for their plans. And I kept saying, let them be the researchers, let them Skype around the world and talk to other schools. And you don't want their opinion, you know, you want their research. I don't care, you know, teenager thinks a classroom should have a disco ball and a bar, you know, but what impacts on the learning, you know. And by the end of the second year, I have an interview with him on my website where he says words to the effect of, you know, if you're going to do this, it has to be learner-led. And if it's not learner-led, it's not even worth starting. You sure as hell, you can't do agency to kids. You can give agency to kids. And there's a real big difference, you know. And so the first thing that happens, of course, is the teacher becomes, you know, more of a kind of research leader, you know, but make no mistake. I mean, teachers know their stuff. We need teachers who know their stuff. And all those years ago when we used to research, teachers to see what genuineness looked like in students' eyes, genuineness was often, about, obviously having an teacher giving you an audience for your work and feedback. But it was also about eccentricity and craziness. People like their, you know, the language teacher to be a bit off the wall, and they come here. I'm sitting here. Folk can't see this, sadly, but I'm busy mixing gunpowder here on the desk, you know, because there's a large space rocket behind me, which we'll be going once we got the mixture right. You know, we'll be going. And kids love that. They need that eccentricity, you know.
And that hint of danger.
They need that hint of safe danger. They really do, you know. And so the teacher's role, I think, becomes a more mature role. I'm not sure I buy all this kind of sage on the stage and guide on the side stuff. I mean, another example, when we're looking at noise in the classroom, you know, one of the things we do simply is to put a decibel meter up on the wall, usually an old tablet or an iPad, and two kids are in charge of noise for the morning or for the day. They're the noise monitors. And if the noise goes up, you know, to above sort of 72, 74 decibels, those kids will go around and shush everyone. Yeah, not the teacher's job. Why should the teacher be responsible for that? The kids know if it's noisy, they can't work. They know that if it's noisy, it will impact on their brains. And then they take it in turns. In Bondi Beach Primary School, I get to work in some lovely places, you can imagine. Bondi Beach Primary School, we had a dining room which was flipping noisy. You know, thermoplastic floors, concrete ceiling, you know, chairs that scraped on the floor, parallel windows of the sound bouncer between. It was from hell. And they'd been given a quote from a local architect firm for tens, twenties of thousands of dollars to soundproof it, and it was just, but the kids were stressed out by it. When the kids should have relaxed at lunchtime, their nerves were jangling just by being in there. So I did some work with the kids, and they, you know, agency, and they said, here's an idea. So they put up in the serving hatch two price lists, and one price list was for the noise below X, and one price list was for the noise above X. And, you know, the minute the noise went high, the prices went up, and they stayed up all week. So, you know, if you, and it turned out,
Is not everyone rushing there to get there early on before there's too many kids there? So
no. It turned out that the kids could manage their noise easily.
Yeah.
And occasionally they'd see a hand going up in the serving hatch towards the prize, and everybody would hush down, you know. Turns out they're perfectly capable of doing all that, you know, in the way that our athletes are perfectly capable of making their own judgments when they've got the data in front of them, you know. So, yeah, it's a much nicer role for a teacher.
Yeah.
That's for sure, because the things that matter are just happening. You've got this lovely, but you have to trust it. So I said, well, what happened when we gave the kids no money? And, rather endearingly, they modeled the future classroom from cardboard. They had a huge interactive screen, but it was cardboard. They had a set of iPads, 10 iPads, but only two were real. 8 were cardboard numbers. You waited your turn, you know. And it had all sorts of features that were made in, you know, chicken wire and brown paper. None of it was real, you know.
Amazing.
But their learning got better. We were gobsmacked. They arrived on time. They stayed later. Their academic results went up. Everything got better. We were like, blimey, you know, what's happened there? Well, of course, it turns out that kids role-playing better learning is better. And they'd stand in front of the cardboard screen talking about what was on the screen, articulating a description of the graphs or whatever, and that was better than just pointing at the screen, you know, even when it was cardboard. So it's all about the kids. It really is. I can't stress that.
And thinking specifically about language learning, language teaching, what recommendations could you give to teachers to make their classroom environments optimum for that purpose, both in resource-richer context, but also in resource-poorer context as well?
Yeah, and I'm a great fan of the less money it costs, the better, because all our work confirms that. When you have to make choices, you do it better. So, you know, the schools, I work in some sumptuous schools around the world, and they'll have one of everything, but the battle to choose is always a battle worth having. So the less money you've got, the better. I mean, up to a point when you're sitting in a field in Pakistan, you know, and you haven't even got parents. But I mean, you know, above that, you know, technology's throwing an interesting curveball at language at the moment. I was in the Google Glass development project, you know, where, and I've done, for people listening, I've just put these slightly dodgy Star Trek-y sort of glasses on, you know, but the cool thing about them was the ability to, if I spoke in English with clear pauses and good grammar, you would see in your glasses what I was saying in Arabic, you know, in a very simple way. So the kind of Douglas Adam Babelfish thing is coming along, but everybody listening to this will know language is a lot more than languages, cultural context, there's all those, you know, there's the semiotics, the signifiers of meaning that are really important. So number one thing, and I'm a bit obsessed by, everywhere your eyes go in the classroom, you want to be led back to learning. And that's really, really, really important. And too often I go into schools and the language stuff is great in the language room, but the minute I'm in the canteen or the corridor or the staircase, you know, it's gone again. So, you know, those faces on the stairs as you walk up to the classroom, you know, mathematicians are teaching prime numbers, you can decline a few verbs, only do what you like with it, really, you know, but creating a sense of language being everywhere is really, really, really important. And you know, being a little eccentric about your own passion, you know, if you're not wearing a beret, something's wrong here, you know, or whatever, you know, or fez. So some of that drama, you know, is necessary. But, and the little things you can do that add fun to that. I mean, if you're in a classroom with a suspended ceiling, those nasty white panels, you know, eBay, you can buy little Perspex sheets the same size for tuppence, you know. Just order yourself half a dozen of those, kick out the white panels, put those in, but put something interesting above it. You know, it could be a French rugby shirt. It could be a pot of turmeric, and you say, oh well, who has turmeric in there? You know, it could be anything you like. But I mean, you know, but the add the richness of the culture to the learning in your room is a huge thing. The number one thing, I think. But secondly, is sound. Our rooms are crap. And I remember my eldest daughter coming home from her GCSE French exam, in which she did dreadfully, despite the fact we spent a lot of time in France, and she's a very good speaker of French. And the reason was the Kumba tape recorder that she was supposed to be listening to, she couldn't hear. You know, it's on the far side of the room. It was knackered. The room was bad. And I said, why didn't he say something? She said, well, it wasn't just me, Dad. It was all of us, you know. And sure enough, all the people in her corner, you know, got a rubbish mark. So modelling sound to make it excellent is a complex thing. But the simple things you can do are to try and take out reverberation. So, you know, if you've got a lot of glass in your room, which you need because you want the light, you're looking for lux levels above 500. I'm only building to 1,000 lux. These days you can measure lux with your phone free app, just go and measure it. Most of the classrooms I go into 150 to 200, way too low for the bit of your brain that needs to do language. So, but on the other hand, you know, the glass vibrates, so you can just stick a few things on the glass. I don't mean all that paper. Teachers love to stick paper on the glass, hide behind it. I don't really know why, but I mean, you know, just sticking up a few fleur-de-lis or a tricolour, you know, whatever, you know, that would work to dampen the vibration in the glass. Think about the floor, you know, we've had kids sitting around the floor just shouting at the floor, measuring it with a decibel meter runs on your phone, and try different covering. What happens if we put a rug in the middle of the floor? Will it be amazed at the difference it makes? Or hang a rug on the wall, or that all works. And also, I know this is bizarre, but opening the door makes the room quieter. And we've spent a lot of time modelling that. If we were sharing the video with you, I'll tell you what, I'll send you the graph. You can share it with people. But, you know, a big room with, you know, 100 kids in, the doors and everything wide open, the kids are quieter. They might have a noisy moment right at the beginning when they all, hello, Chris, good morning. How's your dog? You know, did your dad come home? Oh, sorry to hear that. You know, how about your other dad? Oh, nobody. You know, they're all sort of shouting out across the room, and they need to get on and work. Whereas in a constrained classroom, they're quiet at the beginning because it's boring, and then as you get towards lunch, they fidget and the noise goes up and down. The afternoon's usually right off because kids are noisy, noisy, shut up, noisy, shut up, noisy, shut up, sod off, go home. You know, it's a pretty dismal sort of, and any which way we measure it, closed rooms with the doors shut are noisy, and teachers often don't want to open the door because it's noisy and they don't want other teachers to know that, understandably. But take the doors off, you know. One of my favourites, if there are senior managers listening to this, is to just say, look, closing your door is a cry for help. If you have a situation in your room that you can't manage, shut your door and a senior manager will come in. And that works real good, you know. Every time you shut the door, some clueless deputy leaps in and says, how can I help? Well, yeah, you know, if you're any good, you wouldn't have got...
make that mistake once and once only, yeah.
But it does keep the doors open, you know. And of course, yeah, with COVID, that gives you the ventilation. With CO2, CO2 is a heavy gas. So if you only open the windows, it only goes out above the windowsill. If you open the doors, it goes out down where the kids' heads are on the desk. So doors open is a great thing for controlling the sound and so on, you know.
And how, Stephen, can we link developments in the classroom environment with the wider climate crisis? Where do you see the relationship between those two things?
Well, I mean, COVID has been horrid because of the number of deaths and so many people hideously injured with long COVID. But beyond that, it's been a blessing. And it's been a blessing because it's opened everybody's eyes to outdoor learning again. And, you know, it seems bizarre that we spend a lot of time inside a classroom trying to get the light levels up. I mean, I'm sitting in a a little office. I'll measure this for you while I'm sitting here, you know, and the light levels in here are, you know, pretty good because I'm consciously trying to get them good. But they're still, let me stop faffing, I'll measure the damn thing. So I've got a light meter running on my phone and I'm just going to grab a, so I'm actually, it's a very dull day. I'm running at 418 lux and it should be 500. If I just open the window and shove it outside, dark sky, it is snowing at the moment. And I'm way over 1,000.
Wow.
So, you know, it's, and I'll tell you, if it's a sunny day, we'd be over 10,000. So, and everybody listening to this will remember a time when they did learning out of doors, and it was a memorable moment, you know, it was, so outdoor learning is really, you know, we've got COVID for the next 6, 7, 8, 9 years. So, you know, it's not going to be, don't worry, back to normal by Christmas. The ministers might dream of that because it's all they know, but the reality is, we're in a different world now, and we are in a different world climate too. So being out of doors, suddenly we're acutely aware of pollution, and we're acutely aware of, you know, the CO2 level on the planet is up to nearly 400 parts per million now. Used to be about 270. So that's getting worse. And, you know, there's nothing like being in the planet to be aware of the planet. We on Brightling Sea, we have a beach school runs on the beach here with her preschool kids, and they're down with little digital microscopes looking at the sand, looking for, oh, there's a, found a little red spot. Yeah, that's plastic, you know. So, really? Oh, no. And those kids, they know the, you know, they know the wildlife timetable better than the local fishermen. Hey, you'd see them sort of saying, oh, I see the baby crabs are in. Oh, really? You know, I mean, because they're there every day looking at all this. You know, and I think we've made a big mistake to take learning away from the planet and put it in its own special box, you know. And learning's escaped. That's what's happened. It's sneaked out under the door and the kids have gone with it. And COVID's been a, you know, they're a bit like Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. They're kind of gunning the engine on the bike. You know, they're off. They got away. And but COVID's been a conspirator in all that.
Yeah, you say a nice phrase, sort of, you know, it's escaped from out of its box. But do you think worldwide it's going to be put back in its boxes as soon as it's able? Because it seems to me there's a systemic belief that, you know, learning outside and so on is something you do at primary level. But once you get to the serious aspects of secondary learning or tertiary learning, that goes away again and it should be inside a classroom and all those other things. So,
well, no, because I've never seen anybody say that PhDs can only be done indoors. And, you know, I've had a great track record of PhD students and, you know, they do it where they live and they're outside, you know, and we know that, you know, the impact of pollution on your learning is significant. I'm doing, funny, I've got a webinar coming up on, aerosol pollution, obviously for COVID. And one of the people speaking there, Brendan, is, he's working with Ford. He does intelligent car stuff, you know, and he's working with Ford on geofencing schools. So, you know, if you're driving your transit delivery van, you will not be able to get within half a kilometre of the school because the engine will cut out, you know, unless you've got a, you know, completely zero emission vehicle, you'll have to walk the last half kilometre because anything can be allowed near there. So, you know, suddenly we are acutely aware of all this stuff. And we've got kids mapping their journey to school and saying, you know what, if you don't go through the park, you're risking, you know, that pollution by the road. But if you go through the park, you know, you'll arrive at school with a cleaner oxygen in your head. You'll be ready for learning, you know. And I think that awareness, you know, and also the generation that is this golden generation, you know, before there were the few exceptions, the Greta Thunbergs and the, you know, the kids in Hong Kong or whatever who were kind of, you know, saying their bit about what they thought would happen. That's every kid now. You know, every kid has been given agency. They've tasted the difference. And they ain't going to go. The genie's gone out of that bottle. I've talked to 103 ministers of education in the last 11 months, for which I think that some sort of medal should be struck, you know. And actually, some of them are pretty good, you know. I don't have a collective noun, though. But 2/3 of them are saying, here's a real opportunity to build back better. And one third are saying, it's kind of what happens around the world. You know, if I go to some countries, they don't look at the cost of education because they know whatever they spend, they'll get it back as on the rate of return. You know, Singapore doesn't say how much is that. They say how many do we need? Because whatever they buy, 5 years down the track, national income goes back, they get the money back. And then about a third of the world says, how can we do the same but cheaper? Well, do the same but cheaper got us one gold medal in Atlanta. And, you know, it's dead in the water, that approach, it really is.
What would you say? Because in my experience of working in the global south, you often find actually there's very strong views towards the idea that education should be within a classroom, because it feels there is some prestige attached to that, especially in environments where education hasn't been something that everybody has done from the age of four on onwards. What about in those sorts of environments where even if it's just a concrete shell with poor ventilation and poor windows, but yet people saying there's parental pressure, institutional pressure, saying that's where learning should take place?
Well, I mean, that's what they've been told. And, you know, if I go to some of the desperate bits of West Africa or whatever, where, you know, hugely generous people, often stars, Oprah Winfrey or whoever, you know, have parachuted in and built fabulous schools, you know, but only one or two, there isn't one for everybody. And I was doing an assembly with some kids in Islington the other day, just in passing, talking about safety. And I showed them some of the journeys to school that kids enjoy, you know, the climbing across mountain passes, you know, swinging across a river on a lorry in a tube, the blinking hippopotamuses in the river, you know, and, you know, just basically 2 hours of mayhem to get to school. They get to school, they go into that concrete box, they sit down, they learn about terminal moraines. There ain't no glaciers in Africa, I tell you. And then they go outside and they battle all the way back. And of course, the learning bit was the journey. You know, if they could, somebody had just said to them, well, look at the flora and fauna and think of the engineering of swinging that rubber tube across the river on the end of a bit of rope. And, you know, what do we know about conservation of energy and blah, blah. You know, once the learning is grounded in the place you live, they're not going to get you out of that place and put you back in your box. And that's, you know, and there's some interesting politics about all this, because roughly every 75 years you get a big change. So the 1800 churches around Europe said, we want everybody to learn, put the big book, you know, that's really important, because that's about social behaviours, you know, thou shalt not, dot, 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 you know. And then 75 years after that, we had the, in England, we had the 1870 Act, and most of Europe around about then, because they had industrialization and they needed kids who could do a bit of maths, tell the time, read a notice that said danger. So compulsory primary education came along. 75 years after that, you were with that wartime generation who had been evacuated. And in England, it was the 1944 Education Act, and very similar in France and Germany and elsewhere. But it's interesting that the church was driving it, and then the employers were driving it, and then after the war it was families who drove it because they saw the lack of it, and this time around it's kids who are driving it. But it's every 75 years somebody's given the baton and told make it better, and those have been the really big leaps forward for education, and we're right in the middle of one right now. And I know a few people will go back, but not very many.
With regards to learning English in places all around the world, again going back to this idea of, you know, using the environment around you, all those sorts of things, do you see that impact taking place on language learning and English learning in particular? Because it seems to me often it's presented as it's a prestigious good, you know, it's about the product of gaining an English language ability in terms of grammar, in terms of vocabulary and so on. Do you see that, so what I'm trying to ask is, do you see these things impacting positively on how English is taught and how English is learnt? Or do you think English is somehow separate from many of these other areas that you're talking about?
No, I mean, English has a lucky history of becoming that hugely significant language, which in many countries even affects who you're going to marry, who you're going to work with, what opportunities you have. And there's a really interesting question in all this, which is as we go global and live locally, so, you know, I'm talking to three or four countries a day from this desk, and, yeah, you know, I live in a little tiny village by the waterfront, and I sail a 100-year-old boat, you know, so there's a kind of localness to all this and a globalness to this, and there's a difference here between working with people on your line of latitude, where I can take my project, send it to the east coast of America, on to the west coast, out to Hawaii, around to, where are we, Japan, back to India, Eastern Europe and home, and, you know, while I've been in bed, it's been in five other sort of places, or working my line of longitude where, you know, I'm having lunch in a minute, well, probably am actually, and so are they in Johannesburg, and, oh, let me show you what I've got. Oh, crikey, we haven't got that, you know. So the longitude and latitude workers, and latitude and longitude families for that matter, are, you know, very different styles and approaches. And for one, you really do need a real-time communication code. And I think English is going to be that for a long time. For the latitude ones, maybe you can get away with, you know, all sorts of languages because technology is going to help you out and you're not talking in real time. I mean, we're building a school at the moment in Ireland, which is a modeless school. I think it's the first one in the world. And we're saying there is no difference between being online and being face to face. You know, you're the group of kids you're working with, the collaborative project you're doing, the youngster that you're mentoring, the pastoral support you've got is the same whether you're there or not. And isn't it nice to come in? But it's, you know, your parents go off abroad for two terms. You can go with them and you can still be working with your mates. You can still be doing everything, you know. And, you know, you can see education heading that way quickly. And you know, the thing that becomes important is membership. What do I belong to? Mm. Who is my community? And, you know, communities and membership sometimes need a language. And for now, I think English is very much that placeholder. I could see that being Mandarin not so far down the track too. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time today, Stephen. That was fantastic.
Well, thanks for listening, folks. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. Professor, 31 years ago, whatever. The decade ahead is looking set to be the most exciting time I've ever seen. And I absolutely can't wait. It's in the hands of the kids. They've picked up the baton. They've escaped. We don't know where they're going. But I'm running like hell to keep up with them. And it's just the most exhilarating time.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Stephen.
The Climate Connection.